Okay. Class 4 and final of Chapter 8. And maybe we'll have a shortish class tonight so that we can rest up for Chapter 9. Class 1 was really about the preliminaries, the preliminary preconditions to living a meditative lifestyle, which involves withdrawing from the world, you know, getting used to being alone, being used to separating and isolating your mind and body from all the many, many distractions and stimuli that we are, faced with, bombarded with, really. And class 2 introduced us to the concept of equalizing self and others, equalizing why we're all alike, fundamentally. And then class 3 was the actual practice, the actual meditation of learning how to identify with others. Learning how to identify with others so that you expand your sense of self. Transcend the illusion of separation and realize that we are all one, that we are all connected in the vast nexus of interconnection, interdependence. The fullness, okay, that's the fullness part of the retreat, right? Full and empty, empty and full. And so that's the galactic experience of connection, feeling connected to all beings, wherever they are, you know, wherever they are, in whatever planet, whatever galaxy. One of the really fun sort of spiritual practices that we do occasionally is just go and on a nice moonless night with clear and lie down in the grass. You ever do this when you were a kid? And just look at the sky and open your mind to the vastness of the cosmos. There are, you know, trillions and trillions of stars in the sky. You know, some we can see and some we can't see. Some we know about and some we haven't discovered yet. The universe has not been fully discovered, you know. They're always discovering new. It's like bigger, getting bigger and bigger. It's just, I looked it up on the internet once. The known number of stars is something like 10 to the 17th power. That's how many they know about, let alone the ones that haven't been discovered yet. And to just get that open, like, sense that of how big it is, you know, and how little you are as an individual. And so we feel this sense of, hopefully, we feel this sense of, you know, of sadness, of feeling disconnected, the sadness, the sorrow, the alienation of feeling like we're disconnected, of feeling which is only an illusion, because of course we are all connected. But the strong sense of self that we have, the strong sense of individual self and the grasping to the individual self can be in part eroded and overrided eventually by recognizing how sad that makes us feel. You know, it's not a pleasant illusion. I mean, you know, there's some illusions that are pleasanter than other illusions. It is an illusion that we are separate from one another, and it's not a pleasant illusion. It doesn't bring us happiness. We long for this kind of connection. We long for the connection that has always been there. So, you know, we do our best. We try to connect with other people. You know, that's why we have families. That's why we have friends, is to feel like we belong to something bigger than ourselves. This is why they invented nation states, you know, so you could feel some, like, sense of community with some larger, you know, whole. This is the Sangha, you know, to feel some sense of belonging to, you know, to something bigger than just the individual self. So this practice of equalizing and exchanging self for others is meant to do that on a cosmic level, you know, ultimately, on a cosmic level, so that we overcome this... this sense of alienation, this sense of being atomized, you know, little atoms, you know, with all the other atoms who are not me. And that is the illusion. So we're on Class 4, verse 155, we've done the exchanging self for others practice. And now, as I said at the last end of last class, you know, it's really just a mop-up operation now. Shanti David just kind of closes the chapter with you know, a couple more reflections on the theme. Mostly centering around the disadvantages of not equalizing and exchanging self for others. The disadvantages of not doing the practices that we just covered in the last two classes. For countless eons, you have pursued your own interest, svartha. And despite all this great effort, you've only acquired suffering. It's not like we haven't tried selfishness. We've tried it really hard. You know, kind of day in, day out, our whole lives. You know, and he's talking here about like countless eons. Where just over and over and over again we saw, well, maybe I could be happy just thinking about myself more. Maybe I could be happy that way. You know, this is, I think, a definition of insanity. Where, you know, you just keep trying the same dysfunctional thing over and over again, hoping that the next time it actually would become functional. It's like banging your head against the wall over and over and over again, hoping that one day the wall will crack instead of your head or something, you know. Over and over again, we've tried self-centeredness as a method to happiness. And it doesn't work. All we get is more unhappy, more suffering. Do what I've told you, says Shantideva in this chapter. Do what I've told you, and without hesitation, undertake this right now. You know, he's kind of getting like, oh, you know, come on, get going here. And later on, you'll see the good qualities of doing it. Okay, just try. You've tried the other method, the selfish method. So why not try this one? See if it works, you know. Give it a go. I used to tell my students this. You know, your students who first come, you know, come into the Dharma, you don't really know that it works. You know, you have no experience of like knowing that if you practice an ethical life, if you practice compassion, if you learn to meditate, if you, you know, learn to be less self-centered and more other-centered, that you'll actually be happy. You don't really know that because you never tried it, you know. So, but you've tried the other method. You know what doesn't work. You see? You don't, you know, we all have had plenty of experience of knowing what doesn't work. Self-centeredness doesn't bring happiness. We've tried it over and over and over again. So give this one a go. Why not? You know, try it for a little while and see if it works. Later on, he'll say, you'll see. You'll see that that the good qualities, you call them good qualities, or happiness, begins to arise. The words of the sage are true. The sage means the Buddha here. You know, it's, check it out. Find out if they're true or not. But, you know, he's saying, you know, you'll find out that you'll be happier this way. If you had not in the past left this job undone, this condition of being deprived of happiness and the blessing of the Buddha would not be. If you hadn't, like, avoided doing this, you know, this practice of equalizing and exchanging self for others, you wouldn't be in the shape you're in now. You wouldn't be unhappy. You wouldn't be deprived of the blessing of the Buddha. And so, just as you fabricated an ego, made up an ego, fabricated, on the basis of a few drops of semen and blood that were donated by someone else, by the way, that came from others, you should think about others in the same way. So what is he saying here? The sense of self, the identity, is just fabricated. It's just an idea. We don't have a self. We have an idea of a self. We have a self-conception based on, as he says here, a few drops of semen and blood. It was donated by mom and dad. So, you know, get a body, get a mind, and then we fabricate on top of that. We project a self. So we have a sense of self, that's for sure. But we don't have a real self. We have an idea of the self. And because there is only an idea of the self, that idea can be radically changed and expanded. You can change ideas, okay? You can't change entities. If there was really a self, if there was some kind of real thing that we call a self, then how could you change that? How could you expand it or change it or exchange it to, with somebody else's self or something like that? But it's not like that. And we'll learn a lot more about that tomorrow in Chapter 9. All the reasons, all the arguments why it is impossible. It is simply an illusion that we have the kind of self that we think we have. So, you know, just as a little preparation for that, what kind of self do we think we have? And, you know, the usual kind of laundry list that they go through in the Buddhist texts is, well, we have a self that we think is unchanging. When we think about the self that we think we have, and the way, you know, you're always supposed to get in touch with the thing that you think exists that doesn't exist before you can analyze why it doesn't exist. So you get in touch with what you think exists. So when you say your name to yourself, what does that refer to? Right? There's signifiers and signifieds. Signifier is the word glasses. Signified is this object. Okay? There's a signifier, and this is the object that the signifier signifies. Everyone okay with this? So what's the signified when you say your name to yourself? What does that signify? What is the entity that you think is there that that name refers to? And so, well, it's an unchanging thing. It's something that stretches out over at least one lifespan, right? When you say your name to yourself, you say, when you say me, you say, you know, that means an unchanging entity that has gone through so many years, right? So many years, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years or so, you see? Without change. So we have this sense of a self that is the same self that we were when we were a toddler, and then we went to, you know, primary school, and what, you know, as everything else is changing, right? As our body's changing, as our mind's changing, as our experience is changing, we have this sense of like a witness self that doesn't change, that watches your life go by, kind of, right? Watches you. So that's the unchanging self. Then a unitary self. You know, when you say your name to yourself, you're not referring to a whole bunch of things, right? I mean, unless you've got multiple personality disorder. You're referring to one self, right? When you say your name, you're one self. Well, where's the oneness of the self? You see, where's the unity of the self? Is it somewhere in the body-mind complex? So let's check. Is your body one thing or many things? It's made up of many things, right? Many parts to the body. In fact, so many parts that you can't stop counting them. We went through this, you know, last class. Every part is further divisible into its parts. What about the mind? Is it one thing or many things? There's many different functions to the mind, right? Many different parts of the mind, too. So where is the unitary self in a body-mind complex made up of many, many parts? So where's the unitary self? Where's the unchanging self? Is there any part of your mind and body that isn't constantly going through change? So then the next thing is, well, maybe when I say my name to myself, I'm referring to an entity that isn't part of the mind and body. Because if it's locatable in the body-mind complex, it can't be either unitary or unchanging. Because every part of the body-mind complex is multiple and constantly changing. So that only leaves one other option. Oh, man, I'm not part of the body. Somehow I say my name to myself. I'm not part of the body-mind complex. I'm outside of it. This is what they call the independent self. A self that has, listen to the language, has a body and mind, but isn't the body and mind. Right? I have glasses, but I'm not the glasses, somehow. So we say this, don't we? I have a body. You know, I have a mind. Well, who's the I that has the body and mind? That's an I that can be somehow separable from the body and mind that it has or possesses, right? So that means that you could be back in Bali or Singapore or Hong Kong while your body and mind are here in Indonesia. Doesn't it? Potentially it means that it's separated out. This is totally impossible. Here's another way to think about it, okay? This is one I like a lot. If you are not your mind, if you're separable from your mind, if you have a mind, who's thinking, I have a mind? Which mind is that that's thinking, I am not my mind? I am separable from my mind. You see? A big problem here. You know, when we go through we'll do this in a big way, you know, tomorrow and a bit on Sunday. But when you go through any kind of analysis like this, all kinds of resistance comes up. All kinds. The phantom imaginary self is going to put up a big fight. Because, you know, it's doomed. It knows it's doomed. As soon as you start thinking like this, the imaginary self goes, shh, don't listen. There's some trick here. We'll figure it out later. But don't think about this too much now. You see? Impossible. Here's another one that sometimes they include. A master self. A self that is in charge of me. You know? And, well, where's that one? You know? Where's the master self? If there were a master, that's a complete illusion too. If there were a master, it's very easy to disprove this one. If there was a master self in charge of your mind and body, a self that you know, controls the parts of you, why would that self ever choose to be anything other than happy? Why would that self say, hey, I know, let's wake up this morning depressed? Why would they do that? Why would if there were a master self, you would never be anything other than happy all the time. So it's kind of proof there isn't one. There's nobody in charge there. Let alone being in charge of the world around you. Oh my God. That is so obviously not true. That there's a master self. Why would a master self ever be in a traffic jam? Right? Why would they ever, you know, have air pollution or, you know, whatever it is that, you know. Why would they choose to do that? So the self that we grasp to isn't even there. The self that we are so attached to isn't even there. If you had not in the past left this job undone of like thinking about this stuff, you wouldn't be so unhappy. And so, just as you fabricated an ego, that's where we went off, left off. Just as you fabricated an ego. So the ego, the sense of self, is just an idea of the self. So why not think about yourself differently? Why not think of yourself in a more happiness-producing way rather than in an unhappiness-producing way? The unhappiness-producing way is to think, I am separate from everyone else. I'm all alone here. Remember we talked early in this sequence, we talked, Shanti Davis says, right? You're born alone and you die alone. Who's the you he's talking about there? The ego. The fabricated sense of individual self. So we make up an idea. I am different from everyone else. I'm separate from everyone else. I'm independent, I'm unitary, I'm unchanging. We make up a whole idea of the self, and that self is born alone and dies alone. That fabrication includes this kind of anomie, you know that word? That sense of alienation, that sense of being alone and separate. So just make up a different idea. So Shanti Davis kind of saying that. Just make up a different idea of the self. If all senses of identity, all ideas of the self are just made up, well, why don't you make up one that's better than the little golem, you know, suffering, individual, independent, unitary, unchanging self? And so which one is it? What does he suggest? an all-inclusive self, a self that is the product of bodhicitta, the mindset that is awakening to the fact that we are all connected, that we are all interdependent. Having become someone who lives for others, whatever you find on this body that might be a benefit, pluck it off in your practice of serving the welfare of others. You said this before. It's kind of same verse that he had before. Everything in your body now belongs to everyone else because you are everyone else. You should become envious of yourself by thinking, this one is well placed while the other has poor standing. The other is lowly while this one is lofty. The other works while this one does not. This is a little bit of a reprise of the exchanging self for others, this verse. Be envious of yourself. Become the object of other people's envy. This one means me. I'm well placed while the other has poor standing. Well, that's not right. Others should have higher standing. So, you know, what the other is lowly while this one's lofty. You know, why should I be higher than anyone else? Be envious of yourself. That's what he says. Have envy from the point of view of all sentient beings of you as an individual being and all the advantage that you have. Share it. Become spread the wealth. Kind of like that. I have so many advantages. It's kind of like, I as an individual self have so many advantages. Or you can think of it like this. I, the individual, you know, imaginary individual independent self, am the 1%. I'm the 1%. And that's unfair. I should spread out my advantages to others. Shuck off the attachment to the happiness of the self and chain yourself to the suffering of others. Investigate your dissembling. The Sanskrit is funny here. Chala. Chala means deceit or sham, a fraud. But the text is indeterminate as to whether it's chala or pala. So there's I've gone with chala here. Pala means fruit. Investigate your circumstance, your the fruition of your karma. And notice, you know, when does this happen? But it really makes more sense with chala. So anyway, I'll go with that. Investigate your dissembling, your fraud, your deceit by noticing, when does it happen? When does this grasping to the individual self occur? When does self-cherishing occur? When does it happen? And what does it do? What's the result of it? So be self-aware. Be self-aware of the selfishness that constantly is arising and pay attention to it. Let the bad deeds done by others fall on your head. So some of you have learned a practice called Tonglin, right? Who doesn't know what Tonglin is? Please raise your hand. Okay, this is the exercise for this class, actually, is to do this practice of Tonglin on the basis pretty much of this verse. Let the bad deeds done by others fall upon me. So the practice of Tonglin means taking the suffering of other people onto yourself and then giving them happiness. And you do this on the breath, with the breath. It's a kind of a pranayama. It's a kind of a breath meditation, breath discipline. So on the in-breath, you take in other people's suffering. And then they always say, and you like incinerate it. You burn it up at your heart center. So you imagine like there's a little flame or something like that, a little fire in your heart center. So the negativities of other people you bring in, you willingly take it on. Those of you who know anything about Christianity, this is what Jesus did. Jesus did like the big version of this. Took upon, according to the Christian, you know, theology, took upon the sins of all humanity on himself. Took upon all everyone else's, you know, negativity, and died on the cross. You know, so you're kind of doing a Jesus Christ superstar thing here, just by breathing. On the in-breath, you take away everyone's suffering, and you burn it up inside, and then on the out-breath, you give them all happiness. Like that. Like that. So this is a good secret agent practice to do as you're going through life, you know, where, you know, in Singapore or Hong Kong or wherever you're from. And, you know, there's plenty of opportunity to do that. There's plenty of suffering around, right? You see plenty of it around. So, you know, you pass somebody who's, you know, obviously not having a hard time in some way. You have to do it very subtly, okay? Because otherwise, you know, if you start doing like that, then they probably will arrest you or something. But very, very subtly. And then on the exhale, and give them all, you know, happiness like that. Let all the bad deeds, let the bad deeds done by others fall on your own head, and confess even your small faults to the great sage. So this is, the verb here is prakashaya. Prakasha means bring them to light. And when he's talking about even small faults, you know, he's referring to even the smallest kind of selfishness, self-centeredness. You know, bring those to light and confess them. Let the talk of the glory of others drown out any mention of your own. So when other people are, you know, praise, get praise, you know, join in and make sure that nobody else says anything good about you. And when they start saying, when they start saying something, if they do, sometimes they don't do it nearly enough. Say stuff good about you. You're supposed to say, I rejoice in the good quality that they are praising. Depersonalized, you see? Depersonalized. Not my good quality, but the good quality that they're praising. Let the talk of the glory of others drown out any mention of your own. And like the lowest servant, take upon yourself the task of fulfilling the needs of all living beings. So this is, you know, harks back a little bit to what I was saying before about spiritual pride. You know, you read, this is not the only place that you read this kind of thing. Jesus in the Bible washed the feet of his disciples, which is like the lowest thing. Even in modern day Near East and India and places like that, the feet are the dirtiest, most impure part of the body. It's like wiping somebody else's bottom, dirty bottom. And Jesus willingly did that for his servant, for his disciples. He became the servant of all beings. And he was Jesus. That's pretty good. You know, he wasn't schmucks like us. So if Jesus was willing to do it, why aren't we willing to be the servants of other people? The lowest servant, he says, Nikrishta. Nikrishta means most debased, most reviled, the untouchable. The untouchable dasa. Become the untouchable, you know, servant. And take upon yourself the task of fulfilling the needs of all beings. I, filled with faults, should not praise some incidental goodness of my own. You know, and if we're honest with ourselves, you know, we're kind of a train wreck. Every one of us is pretty much of a train wreck. Lots and lots of bad things. Lots and lots of faults. Lots and lots of, you know, negative thoughts and mental afflictions and all like that. And then he says, and you know, maybe once in a while some incidental good thing happens, you know, rises up in us. And then we make a big deal of it, you know. Oh, I was so generous, you know. After being selfish like for 25 years, I was generous for 5 minutes. So I filled with faults, should not praise some incidental goodness of my own. I should act such that no one might know of my good qualities. Okay? That's a real spiritual activity. The real spiritual activity is anonymous. Anonymous. Not like saying, oh, what an awesome, you know, yogi I am, or I've reached this level of meditation, or I'm a realized being, or I'm a bodhisattva. All very anonymous. Yeah. In sum, whatever wrongdoing towards others you have performed out of self-interest, let that offense fall on yourself for the benefit of living beings. You're just going complete sacrificial lifestyle. Complete sacrificial lifestyle. I should not be given encouragement for being a loud mouth. It's a very interesting word in Sanskrit. It's mukara. Mukara. Muka means mouth, actually. Mukara in the dictionary says it means talkative, loquacious. So I translate that. I'm very proud of this translation, actually. Loudmouth. I should not be given encouragement for being a loudmouth. I should conduct myself like a blushing bride, modest, timid, and inhibited. Humble. Do this. Stay like this. This is not to be done by you. These are the orders that you're giving yourself. In this way, take control of yourself. And when there is a transgression, impose a punishment. This is a little bit like, what was that? That section, what chapter was that in, Cindy, of Be a Bump on the Log? Is that 6th chapter, patience chapter, I think. So like when you're interacting with others and you start to feel like, you know, resentment or anger or something like that, just stay still, like a bump on a log. Don't do anything. You know, don't respond. When you feel the mental affliction arise, don't give into it. Just, you know this expression in English? Everyone holds still, nobody gets hurt. I think bank robbers use it when they come in and like knock off a bank or a 7-Eleven or something. You know, come in with guns. Okay, everyone stay still, nobody gets hurt. So, like that with your mind. Everyone stay still here. You know, do this, stay like this. Don't do that. Be hard on yourself. He's like I'm saying, be hard on yourself for not being of benefit to others. Be hard on yourself for being selfish. O mind, if you do not do this when you're told to, I will discipline you. For in you reside all faults. All dosha. Dosha. Dosha means, you know, fault. So this is one of the many, many places in this text and in many, many others that tell us, you know, to take responsibility for ourselves. Take responsibility for our own happiness and unhappiness. No one else can make you happy. It is your job to make yourself happy. Other people can't make you happy. And then, you know, we go through life thinking that it's other people's job to do this, right? Well, you know, I married you. You're supposed to make me happy. You're not making me happy. I married you. I love you. Why aren't you making me happy? You know, they can't do it. It's not in their power to make you happy. And conversely, no one can make you unhappy except for you. See? So no blame. You know, if only I didn't have you in my life, then I'd be happy. You make me so unhappy. Nobody can make you either one. Take responsibility. In you, in your mind, in the mind resides all faults. Where will you hide? I see you. He's talking to his own mind here. I will smash all your vanity. The time when I was ruined by you is past and gone. Time I was ruined by your selfish self-centeredness is past and gone. Now it's time to give up the expectation, asha. Which expectation is that? Well, there's still my own self-interest to consider. It's time to give that up. Time to give up the expectation of, well, what about me? What about me? If I'm concerned about everyone else all the time, well, what about me then? Who will be concerned for me? If I'm concerned, if I'm not concerned about me, who will be concerned about me? So this is like one of the first things I think that arise in as an objection in one's mind when one's reading things about being a completely other-directed person. Well, who's going to take care of me then? And Shanti Deva basically will say, you will only be taken care of if you stop thinking about taking care of yourself all the time. Only. It's the problem. Remember, all suffering in the world comes from what? Come on. Thinking about your own happiness all the time. Thinking about you all the time. All unhappiness comes from that. All happiness in the world comes from thinking about the happiness of others. So if you want to protect yourself, if you want to further your self-interest, stop thinking about your self-interest. And think about the interest of others. If I do not happily give you to living beings, You will no doubt deliver me to the guardians of the hell realms. He's, yeah, again, talking to his own ego, talking to his own sort of selfishness. Giving me up like this many times, I have long been distressed by you. Keeping these grievances in mind, remembering like how dysfunctional it has always been to be self-centered. Keeping this in mind, I will, where am I? Keeping his grievances, I will smash you. Oh, I will smash you, he says. You slave to your own self-interest. Here's a really cool verse, very important verse, 173. If you really love yourself, do not go about loving yourself. If you really want to do what's good for you, stop thinking about yourself all the time and what's good for yourself. Think about somebody else, which is the best thing you can do for who? For yourself. If you really love yourself, do not go about loving yourself. If you really are going to protect yourself, it is not proper to protect yourself. Your protection comes from the protection that you offer to other people. The more one indulges, then he's back to the body again. Back to the, no, I mean, it's, there's a reason for that. You know, I sort of was trying to underline it before. Our sense of isolation and separation from other people really derives from thinking that we are our body. I mean, you know, you can't quite sort of overemphasize that. It is because we are convinced ourselves, and we've had a lot of help in modern culture. We've convinced ourselves that we are our bodies, and that we are only our bodies. So that's why he keeps harping on it, I think, over and over again. The attachment to the body is very, very strong. The physical body is very, very strong. And the ramifications of that are to give us this sense of separation from other bodies. Because obviously we are separate from other bodies. If we are our bodies, then we are not other people, right? So if we're going to identify with others, let alone all sentient beings, we can't identify with our body. We have to sort of like think of our body at best as a vessel, or, you know, a hired rental car that we're just like in for a while, and, you know, then the car breaks down, of course, right? And then you call up, you know, Hertz or Avis or whatever those rental car agencies is, I need another car. That's rebirth. That's called rebirth. So you hire another car. The more one indulges in this body, more one indulges this body, the more fragile and degraded it becomes. Have you noticed that? We in general in the modern age have become softer and softer and softer. I mean, you know, Cindy and I live in the country where there's a little bit less of that, you know. People, and not so long ago, people put up with all kinds of physical hardships that we just would find intolerable now because we've gotten so soft. We've indulged the body so much. You know, people would just grin and bear it. You know, got this problem, got this sickness. I don't have indoor plumbing. You know, big deal. I was talking about going to Ireland. When I went to Ireland, which is now about 10 years ago, it was pretty apparent that most Irish were like only a generation or two from having indoor plumbing. And Ireland is no place to go outside to the bathroom. It's cold there, okay? So, you know, you get in the middle of the night, you have to go pee or, you know, poo or whatever it is. You got to go up and freeze. You freeze, go outside, freeze into some stinky outhouse. And they didn't think twice about it. You know, this is life. I'll tell you another story about Ireland. I did a retreat in Ireland. I learned a lot in Ireland. I did a long-term retreat, a four-week retreat in Ireland. And so it was in a cottage, a country cottage. So I went with some friends to look at the place before I went on retreat. And I talked to the landlady who was, you know, hiring it out. And she was giving me the tour of the place. And she said, you know, and if you you know, if you want hot water, you have to start burning peat. You know, this is what they burn there. This is like bog grass that's kind of concentrated into a brick. You have to start burning the peat like in the morning. And all day long you burn the peat, and then by evening you have enough hot water to take a bath. You know? And then she said, but of course it's summer. Like, what do you need hot water for? It's, you know, summer in Ireland? Summer in Ireland, the hot day is like 13 degrees. You know? When the sun shines in Ireland, everyone like stop in the summertime. Everyone just stops work and goes to the beach immediately, because like it's not going to last very long, right? You know, it's like 2 hours of sunshine and then it's back to like cloudy, rainy, cold weather again. It's summer. What do you need hot water for? So people lived quite differently in the very recent past. The more you indulge the body, the more fragile it gets, and the more demands it makes. When it has degenerated like this, even this whole earth will, with all its riches, will not be sufficient to satisfy its desire. You know, nothing satisfies the insatiable ego. Nothing, right? Like Mick Jagger said, you just can't get no. Can't get no. And you try, and you try, and you try, and you try, but you can't get no satisfaction. We heard the Rolling Stones are another like really interesting teaching. Cindy and I went to hear them. When was that?
November.
This November in Australia. The Rolling Stones are 70 years old now. Okay. Mick Jagger, I think, 72 years old, running up and down the stage like a 20-year-old. You know, it's just amazing, just amazing. And Keith Richards is alive, which is also. Who would have thought that, right? They've been a rock and roll band for 50 years. 50 years, okay? And they did their set, and they did Satisfaction. They did some of those. How many times do you suppose that the Rolling Stones have played I Can't Get No Satisfaction? And they played it as if it was the first time they had ever played it. 50 years of playing it, and they just brought newness to it, you see? That's a really good teaching, you know, about like bringing this kind of excitement to even the most routine aspects of life. We were impressed by the Rolling Stones altogether. All right, where am I? It was that verse about the Rolling Stones. Where is that one? For one who wants what he can't get, mental afflictions and disappointment arise. Yeah. Expectations are disappointments in training. If you always want what it is that you don't have, here he's saying it a little stronger, what you can't get, you're just going to be disappointed all the time. But for one who is without expectation, nir asha, without expectation, there is always unspoiled success. So this is a wonderful kind of concept of, you know, how to live happily. Be satisfied. Be satisfied with what you have and don't hope for anything different in the future. And just relax already. This terrible and impure form, what do you suppose he's talking about there? Back to the body. Ends in ashes. Immobile and moved by another, why then do I grasp onto it as mine? What does it matter to me whether this contraption is living or dead? How is it different from something like a lump of clay? Oh, why do you not destroy the ego? I don't know, is there anyone here who has never seen a dead person? You all seen a dead person, a corpse. I don't know about you, but when I saw my first dead person, you know, you kind of can't quite believe it. You kind of like want to, you know, poke them a little bit and say, you know, get up, you know, move a little bit. But they're just like inert. They're just matter. the body just becomes matter. The body has always been just matter. It's always just been like a lump of clay. But there's something inside, the ghost in the machine, that animates it for a while, and then, quits. Cindy's dad used to say the body's just like a car, you know. It runs out of gas and then it quits. Right? Runs out of fuel and then it just stops. And all our bodies are like that. It's just lumps of clay. So why are you so attached to it? Why do you grasp onto it as yours, as me, as the ego? By siding with the body, one pointlessly procures suffering. By thinking that you are your body, you are just going to suffer. Is there anyone unclear on that? This is an accident waiting to happen. If it's not already happened. I mean, you know, all kinds of accidents already happened. If you live just a few decades, you know, all kinds of stuff start going wrong. But eventually it's going to totally let you down. This is the big misunderstanding among many people about yoga. No, I mean, people think that yoga is about beautifying the body. And if you look at like Yoga Journal and stuff like that, it is almost 180 degrees wrong. The message that you get from, you know, from yoga pornography. You never see ugly people in yoga magazines, okay? You never see kind of like fat, overweight people doing, you know, downward facing dogs. They're all like just beautiful, lithe, young, and they're always in exotic places. You know, they're always in Costa Rica or, you know, somewhere. You never see them in like Detroit, you know, or downtown Hong Kong, you know. This is just attachment to the body. And the body will definitely, yoga, the purpose of yoga is not to get more attached to the body, just the opposite. Is to understand that the body is just a tool. It's just a, you know, like a machine. And you are not your body. You learn to control your body, right? That's the asana practice. You learn to be the master of your body, not to identify with the body. Yeah? And many of the more advanced practices of yoga are pretty kind of hardcore this way. You know, all of the, what they call kriyas. Here's one, for example. You stuff a whole bunch of, like, cloth down your throat, and you get it all down there in the lower intestine, and then you pull it all out with all the junk that comes out with it. Or here's another. Does anyone not know about these practices? Yeah, and here's another one. You put a whole bunch of water up your nose and then like have it all come out this way, or a thread that comes up here and then you go. No, I mean, yeah. Or enemas, right? You know, these are not to like further your romance with your body. I mean, these are meant to like give you some sense of objectivity about the body. It's just an object, you know. Anyway, that's my rant on yoga.
Sana reminded us not to practice today to get a good yoga bun.
Yeah, okay. All right. By siding with the body, what's the use of getting angry with or being courteous towards something that's equal to a piece of wood? Just talking about the body here again. Whether it's cherished by me or eaten by vultures and other animals, it feels neither love nor hate. Body's just material. It's just physical thing. It doesn't have any feelings at all, actually. So why am I so fond of it? So interesting that he's just like comes back to the body over and over and over again. He's kind of ending the whole chapter like this. That which is not aware feels no wrath when reviled, nor satisfaction when honored. He's talking here again about the body, which is not a conscious thing. It's a physical thing. That which is not aware feels no wrath when reviled or satisfaction when honored. For whom am I exerting myself? This attachment to the body. Those who like this body, I consider my friends. Isn't it? That's a very interesting kind of like definition of friendship. They like my physicality. They like my body. They like being with me. We say that, right? We like being with me. Those who like this body, I consider my friends. But everyone likes their own body. So why don't I feel affection for them? Everyone's the same. Everyone likes their body. Those who like my body, I consider my friends. Everyone likes their body. Why don't I consider all of them my friends? And so with an indifference, anapeksha, impartiality. And so with indifference, I renounce my body for the benefit of the world. Even though it has many faults, I employ it like a work tool, like a wrench or a screwdriver. That's how he says we should regard our bodies. As just something, karma bandha, bandha. Bandha means implement. An implement for karma, an implement for action. Just a tool to use to help others. Enough of this worldly behavior. I will follow the learned, recalling what they have said about vigilance and warding off apathy and sloth. Therefore, I will concentrate on eliminating the obstructions. Avarana, maybe I should have translated that obscuration. Because avarana means a covering, some kind of hiding. I will concentrate on eliminating the obstructions or obscurations and turning my mind away from its evil ways, perpetually rest in my own foundation. Very interesting way to end the chapter. So, what is my own foundation? Sva-alamba. Sva-alamba means your own support system, your own foundation or base. And then there's this this avarana, these coverings. So what is the obstruction and what is the foundation that he's talking about here? And I don't know for sure, but here's a guess. That the obstructions are what, or obscurations, are the what's covering up your true self, your true nature, your true foundation, as it says here. So, what are they? What are the clouds that are covering the clear blue sky, which is who you really are? Pure. Perfect, in no need of work at all, because you're already and have always been pure. Your Buddha nature, as they say. So what are the clouds? Well, you know, they often say kleshas. Kleshas are the clouds, the mental afflictions. The mental afflictions are the clouds that cover your true nature of the blue sky. And then we identify with our mental afflictions. We say, I am angry, I am proud, I am envious, and so forth, instead of identifying with our foundation, as he says here, our true foundation, the clear blue sky. And the ultimate mental affliction, the mental affliction behind all mental afflictions is ignorance, they say. Ignorance, avidya. It is the kshetra, the field in which all the other mental afflictions grow. So what is ignorance? There's all kinds of ways that we're ignorant. But we're ignorant especially about who we are. We think that we're the self that we've imagined ourselves to be. We think we are that. We think we are the individual ego. And then we grasp to it. And that's the biggest cloud in the sky, actually. All other clouds come from that. And obscure our recognition of who we really are. Who we really are is the Buddha. And we've always been the Buddha. You don't have to become the Buddha. You have to recognize yourself as the Buddha. Okay? And stop grasping on to the illusory identity of the clouds. Clouds are also just passing by the way, right? Clouds just pass by. Clear blue sky doesn't move, doesn't go anywhere. The clouds just pass by. So the clouds are impermanent. The clouds are changing. The clouds are born, they last for a while, and then they die. And that's the case with all of us. If we grasp to the individual sense of self as ourselves, we will definitely die. Definitely die, okay? You will not become immortal as you. Impossible. That's X-Man stuff. You know? It's cartoons. And it would be a disaster anyway. Can you imagine being yourself forever? Yeah, it'd be pretty bad. Right? Fortunately, it won't happen. Okay? So, if you're looking for immortality, you know, many religions promise this, don't they? They promise eternal life or immortality or deathlessness, overcoming death in some way or another. Right? But that, the only way to overcome death is to re-identify yourself. Because if you're identified with the individual who has a birthday, you will definitely have a death day. Definitely. So to re-identify yourself. So how do you do that? Well, you know, the whole text is about how to do it. The Mahayana version of how to radically re-identify yourself is through bodhicitta. Through a mindset that is awakening to the fact that you are everyone. The you is everyone and everything. That there is no separate self. So it's this kind of enlargement. So, you know, we're finished with the fullness part now. The fullness of fullness and emptiness. Or what do we say? Empty and full. This is supposed to be the name of the retreat, in case you were wondering why I keep talking about empty and full. So we're done with the full part, because that's what bodhicitta is feeling this fullness, this plentitude, this sense of completeness, you know, when it comes to identity. Completeness. Nothing excluded. Everything included. And then, beginning tomorrow, we'll start the empty part. You can see it from one way, you can see it from another. Doesn't matter how you see it, it comes to the same thing. All right. Sleep well. Get a seriously rest up, okay? For chapter 9.